Hello, fellow Oral History Review readers and listeners. This is Nicole Strunk, and I'm the editorial assistant here at the OHR. And today I'm joined by Tom Ikeda to talk about his oral history project, now titled Densho. This project aims to seeing the stories of Japanese Americans who were held in internment camps in World War II, as well as some of the experiences of their relatives. Let's get started. So, Tom, would you mind explaining some of the creation of the Densho project with me? I mean, I guess, how did you come to oral history, and how did you decide to, like, start this project?
You know, when I think about how this project got started, yeah, I want to go back 35 years and tell a short story.
Please do.
About, you know, in some ways, the power of story. So 35 years ago, I was dating my wife. And she's a Japanese American, as I am. And I met her father, and over the kitchen table, he told me a story of during the war of being a draft resister, you know, a person that was incarcerated in one of the, you know, the American concentration camps that was holding Japanese Americans. And he was drafted to serve in the military while being incarcerated. And when he resisted, he ended up spending 3.5 years in a federal penitentiary. And when I heard that story, I remember kind of my jaw dropping because, you know, I knew what happened to my family. My dad was a World War II veteran who, from the camps, you know, when he was drafted, served. And so I knew that story. But when I heard the story of my father-in-law, I recognized there were just so many powerful stories that I didn't know as a Japanese American, and that these stories weren't really well known. So that was actually the seed that told me how important the stories were in the Japanese American community, and how many of them weren't being, you know, documented or shared. And so it was actually 12 years after that kitchen talk that the Japanese American community in Seattle was starting to talk about doing an oral history project for the community. And when they approached me, I said, yes, you know, I would actually be interested, because in particular, if we can focus on those stories that were, you know, less told, less known. And so that was, in some ways, for me personally, you know, the pathway, because, you know, my own family, you know, my dad and my mom were both incarcerated, as well as my grandparents. And so I knew those stories, and I wanted to also, you know, document and share those. But it was just knowing how wide-ranging, how diverse the stories were, and how important they were to capture really all of them.
Wow. So you would, I guess you could definitely say that your past and identity as a Japanese American contributed to this project and the storytelling mission that you made.
Yeah, very much so. When I share these stories, you know, whether it's from some of you know, people I know, like families or friends, or other people in the community, you know, I think people get a sense of how personal the story is to me. And I think, you know, I think about in terms of sometimes practices and you know, doing oral histories, and you know, that that connection in terms close you are to the story. And I always make it clear in terms of, you know, my personal connection. But I think having those not only personal but community connections allows the stories to come out perhaps differently in terms of how you collect it from the community. You know, an example is, you know, when we first started this project, you know, many Japanese Americans who went through the World War II incarceration didn't necessarily want to talk about the story. And I think having me sort of being part of the community, growing up in the community, and many of them knowing me, I think that gave many people in the community a sense of comfort that if they shared their stories, it would be treated with a lot of sensitivity, a lot of respect. And so I think that really helped to open up and get a lot of people in the community to share their oral history who would not have done that otherwise. So that's kind of an example in terms of, you know, some ways recognizing how my personal connection, you know, I have to, you know, kind of understand, you know, my perspective and perhaps my biases because I'm so close to it. but also seeing it as a strength in terms of getting stories that perhaps other oral historians may not be able to get.
Very much so. And you're not an oral historian by trade, correct? So that's definitely another part of that.
No, and so, you know, in terms of why the Japanese American community approached me, my undergraduate training is in chemistry and chemical engineering. I did software development at Microsoft, and I had recently left Microsoft, having developed back then we called these multimedia CD-ROM products. Mm-hmm. And the Japanese American community had heard about another project that was using technology. This was a project started by Steven Spielberg, and it was called the Showa Project, mm-hmm. where they were doing video oral histories of Holocaust survivors. And so I flew down with a few others down to Los Angeles, visited the studios, their studios down at Universal Studios, and got a sort of a behind-the-scenes tour of what they were doing.
Wow.
And because of my technology background, people want me to see this because they said, so Tom, can we do this in the Japanese American community? And what I saw at the Showa Project, which was exciting, was workstations where I could do these searches on a camp or a particular experience, and the stories would appear, and I could view them immediately on a monitor. On the downside, it was very expensive technology because they were using all mainframe technology. They were using fiber optics, and the light bulb went on because having just recently left Microsoft, I realized that we could replicate everything that I was seeing using personal computer technology. And furthermore, with the emergence of the internet, I knew that we could share these stories, across the globe, in ways that, could really transform in terms of how we would share these stories. And so I came back to Seattle, again, not as an oral historian, but knowing in some ways the importance of the stories from my family, along with this sort of background and experience in technology, and then having seen a model at the Showa Foundation, all these pieces came together, 23 years ago in Seattle. And that was the genesis of Densho when we first got started.
Wonderful. And I guess looking back, I think I forgot to ask you at the beginning, could you explain the title of Densho? Why did you decide to call the project that, and what does that mean?
Yeah, that's a great question. When we started, I think the first few months we called ourselves the Japanese American Legacy Project. And it was very generic. And mm-hmm. we recognized that what we were trying to do was very different. And we wanted a name that people could remember. And we kind of spent weeks and weeks talking about this. And then someone actually came up and suggested a Japanese term, densho, which means to pass stories on to the next generation, kind of like a legacy. And that really resonated with our group because, as we were asking people to be interviewed, many of our elders would say, oh, my story's not important and, no one wants to hear it. And what would resonate with them was when we told them, well, it's really important for the future generations to really understand what happened to you and the community. And this may happen in 50 years or 100 years when we're all gone, and yet the stories will be there and they'll be so important for the future generations. With that kind of explanation, our elders, got it. They said, okay, so I get it. It's not for me. It's not even for my kids. It's really for these future generations. And that name, Densho, in terms of, preserving stories for the future generation, really resonated with our narrators and our community. And that was the background for that name.
That's very powerful. I guess, moving on from that, I guess you've talked a little bit about how Densho has changed in just the name. How else has Densho changed since you began the project?
Yeah, so this are probably, I think the oral historians in your and who hear this will appreciate this. So we start off really focused as an oral history project, and we're focusing on doing the interviews. But as an oral historian, the research involved for each interview was important, and so we would collect documents, photographs. As we met people and interviewed them, they would share more of their materials. And what we recognized quickly was how powerful the oral history interviews were in documenting things, but we had all these other materials. And so the project quickly expanded to also document and preserve, things like those historic photographs, those documents, those letters, those diaries, because as powerful as a oral history interview is in terms of talking about painting a scene or talking about feelings or what people were thinking, we recognized when it came to things like remembering dates or locations, mm-hmm. that all these other documents and other pieces were really powerful. And so what we did was we created this online platform that not only could you access all these video oral histories, but you could also access all these historic documents, photographs that would kind of align or relate to what that person was saying. And then furthermore, we recognized with these kind of raw primary sources, you also had to provide some historical context to that. So we also created a very in-depth online encyclopedia about the World War II Japanese American incarceration. And it's roughly about 1,500 articles, mm-hmm. about the events, the places, the people, the whole process, so that as people are exploring the stories or these documents, they also have this context written by scholars and researchers about what happened, to update that also. So what we've been doing is really trying to, again, using the foundation of these oral history interviews to provide the rich context that helps a viewer make sense of what that person's talking about.
Very much so. As you've talked about how's expanded, how does your team work? Who do you work with? How do you get this information? Like, who does the oral histories? Who does some of the historical background? Can you talk a little bit more about your team?
Yeah, so currently we have a team of on staff of about four of us who do the oral histories. In the very early days of Densho, we started off down a path of training volunteers to do our interviews. And what we found was after we did the first 100 interviews, we did an assessment, and we recognized that working with volunteers, the quality of the interviews differed based on who did the interviews and how much training they had, how much effort they put into it. And after that, we actually shifted more to a more staff professional interviewer model. And that helped. And the reason that I'll use myself as an example. So I personally have done about 250, video oral histories. And as I do them, what I recognize is the knowledge and the experience of the previous hundreds of interviews I've done really helps as I go forward, because there's so much knowledge that I've acquired just from the stories, plus all the research and reading I do. But just hearing the stories, and you can start connecting them. You can even bring in like 5 years ago I interviewed someone with a similar story that this was kind of situation. Can you explain what it was like for you? And just having that experience and knowledge was really helpful. So we've done that. So in general, our interviewers you know, are you know, better trained. They have more knowledge. And in some cases, we also specialize in different areas. For instance, I do a lot of the draft resistors, you know, the World War II veterans, you know, kind of the men. And we have, you know, women interviewers who, you know, for, I think, you know, for gender reasons, you know, they you know, can appreciate and be more sensitive to some of the issues about, like, you know, raising a child while being incarcerated and those kind of issues. So we kind of specialize in different areas. So so we have about a you know, a team of four that actually conducts interviews. We also have on staff someone who can video record these interviews. But we also use, as we travel to different parts of the country, we oftentimes hire a videographer to record the interviews. And then the interviews, you know, come, you know, the file comes back to Densho, where it goes through a pretty intensive process of, you know, transcription. We index by topic, you know, what's being done. You know, obviously we digitally preserve it, not only locally on site here, but also off site, just in case, you know, something happens to our building. Mm-hmm. And then we web publish it so that it's available. You know, the transcript, the video files are all available online, and so that's kind of, you know, kind of a rough outline of our process.
Wow. So I guess now that we know about the process, we have to talk about the most important part, which are the narrators. How do you get in contact with them? You started more locally, but you've expanded so much. How do you get in contact with people across the country?
Yeah, so this is kind of a process over time that's evolved. You know, at the very beginning, you know, I mentioned how we want to really focus on the stories less told. And we recognize that if we immediately went to your more established Japanese American organizations and said, hey, you know, we're doing this project, can you tell us who to interview? That in many ways we would be tapping into the stories that in some ways had already been known. Yeah. And so we did in the Seattle area, we went to the voter records and did a match of the last names of the people who were incarcerated with the voter records, and also did the age bracket. And we then did a random pool of about 400 names in the greater Seattle area. And we reached out to them, recognizing that this would be a more random sampling of the Japanese American community, and first did a survey to collect as much information as we could in terms of their experiences, what happened, some of their thoughts. And then we asked them if they would be willing to be interviewed, or could they recommend someone for us to be interviewed. And what we found was that gave us a much wider perspective in terms of who to interview. I mean, obviously, we had to go and convince people to be interviewed, which is part of that process. But but that started us off getting a much more balanced, diverse pool of narrators, especially in terms of gender, that we found that when we looked at previous oral history projects around this topic, it tended to be like 75% plus male in terms of who was interviewed, and not as many women, as an example. So we really were conscious of things like that. So that was the origins. But then as we filled out the collection, we looked at you know, what we had, the topics we were covering, and especially talking with scholars as they're coming across in terms of emerging themes, emerging ideas, we recognized that there were certain holes that or gaps in terms of us not covering. You know, I mentioned in some cases, you know, like childbirth in the camps, or another topic that we were looking at was some of the racial relationships or the relationships with other racial groups. And so we start looking at those things, In that case, what we did was we kind of put a call out to the community that we would specifically say we are looking for certain things. And through word of mouth, we would find candidates to be interviewed. And then the other thing, geographically, we did the same thing. We looked at whether or not we had good coverage for all 10 of the WRA camps that, you know, held Japanese Americans, as well as the, you know, the 17 assembly centers. And we tried to get stories from each one of those geographic locations. So it was kind of that process of starting with what we thought was a solid base, and then looking for those gaps, again, working mostly with scholars. And currently we have close to 1,000 of these interviews in our archive that are all indexed so that, you know, people can search and look at these different topics, geography, you know, different themes that we've covered.
Wow, that is incredible. That's the amount of interviews you've been able to do as well. Looking, now that you've had that many interviews done and you've listened to so many stories, have you noticed that either in yourself or any responses to Densho has changed some previous understandings about the past or opened any doors that people didn't know about the Japanese American internment?
Well, so let me answer it this way in terms of something that opened up that I didn't realize when we first started the project. Because when we first started, we talked about, you know, I talked about how, you know, these stories that weren't documented, we wanted to make sure that they were, and we wanted to share them. The thing that surprised me while we were doing those first 100 interviews as a pilot was that after we would do an interview with someone that had never been interviewed, and in some cases had never shared some of the stories that they shared with us, you know, sometimes they would get very emotional. And there was one woman in particular that we interviewed, and when she finished, you know, she was you know, crying. And she talked about how, you know, and she said this in, you know, something that you know, caught my attention, because she said, "Well, now I can die." And, you know, we were, at first I was a little concerned in terms of, you know, maybe the you know, mental health issues in terms of, mm-hmm. you know, did we stir up something that might, you know, cause someone to you know, concern. But as she talked, I realized it wasn't that. It was that, you know, she had shared something that, you know, that was very personal, but was something that she was holding for, you know, literally over 50, 60 years. And it was like, what she was saying was this huge weight had been lifted. And she could see how, although she was crying, they're almost tears of joy of getting rid of something that, you know, had haunted her for so long. And then what we saw was, you know, shortly after that, I would get emails or a phone call from, you know, the children or grandchildren of the people we interviewed saying, "Wow, what happened? Because, you know, grandma is so different. You know, she's now sharing things that we've never heard, that, you know, she's so much lighter. She's so different." And it didn't just happen once. It happened over and over again. And what we recognized was the healing process. What was going on. It's kind of like, you know, reminding me of some of the reconciliation interviews and processes that have gone on around the world, that, you know, when you just give voice to, you know, victims or people who have gone through this traumatic experience, how healing that can be. And so we saw that happening in our community. So in some ways, you know, more than just uncovering new historical items by doing these oral histories, we recognize that the process was actually impacting a community, especially a community that, you know, had gone through such a traumatic experience that for many of them, they still, even though they did nothing wrong, there's a sense of shame. You know, we must have done something wrong or something happened for the government to, you know, take us away from our homes and put us into these camps and put us under armed guard. And then at some point they're released and no one ever told them what they had done or ever told them that what they had done, wasn't bad. And so we were able to, through this process, help many individuals heal, which helped heal, we saw families and communities as we went forward. So when I talked about earlier how so many people were reluctant to talk about their what happened during World War II, part of that was the shame that they were feeling. And we see much less of that now. I think the community now recognizes what had happened to them and are much better able to share those stories. So that's something that I think was really powerful in terms of what was uncovered during this process.
Definitely. Do you see the documenting and sharing of these stories as something that could serve as a signpost or as an example in the future for either current political situations or ones that have happened more recently since the Japanese American internment?
That's a great question. And because of the public access nature of our archive and the generosity of the narrators who allow their stories to be shared, we've had millions of people view and see these stories, and the majority of them are not from the Japanese American community. And in particular, more recently, we've been working more with the American Muslim community, that when they see the stories of what happened to Japanese Americans 76, 77 years ago, and they hear kind of the concerns, how they were targeted, how even though they did nothing wrong, that they're viewed as somewhat dangerous, and perhaps rights are restricted because of that. The stories have resonated so much with them, and so more and more, they understand and recognize that what is happening to them today is part of patterns that have happened in our American history over centuries. And I've had similar comments from the African American community that when I go down to last year I was at Birmingham at the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute and shared the stories of the Japanese American community, and they have this fabulous oral history collection down there around the local people during the civil rights movement, and the similarities of the stories were striking in terms of what people were saying. Same thing about immigration. When I work with some immigrant rights groups, and they tell me what what's going on, and I share some of the stories that we heard from our community, especially when people are talking about their parents who immigrated to the United States in the early part of the 1900s. The stories are so similar. So what we're finding is, in many ways, it's very helpful to these communities to be able to see that. What happened that when people are saying, "Oh, your community is dangerous," or "your community is somehow we should be fearful of them," for them to see that the same thing happened to Japanese Americans and it wasn't true, and it was part of this failure of political leadership, this racism, fear, and that these factors and how they caused this, to the Japanese American community, leading to the World War II incarceration, and later on the government, much later on, decades later, recognizing they did make a mistake, they apologized, but for communities in the sort of the crosshairs of this targeting right now, it is helpful for them to understand this. And with our collection and the stories and our ability to do this context, I think it's helpful and easier for these vulnerable communities to understand that.
Definitely. As Densho has expanded in number of narrators, but also in or past the Japanese American community, what is the future for Densho? Is there another project you plan on taking on or expanding even more?
Yeah, so I go back to my engineering roots in that, we're always constantly looking at ways to improve. Not only are we, increasing the size of our collection by doing more oral histories, collecting more historic photographs and documents to provide context, writing more articles, creating educational curriculum to help students not only learn about the Japanese American incarceration experiences, but to link them to current events, to help students understand how to use oral histories or historic photographs to examine these issues, critical thinking skills. So all that is happening sort of on this online platform that we're working with. But and other things in terms of the online platform that we're doing is we're opening up in ways that other institutions around this topic can start preserving and hosting their materials on this platform, so that a user, when they come, they won't just look at Densho interviews, but they'll look at interviews from the Japanese American National Museum in Los Angeles, or the Japanese Cultural Center in Honolulu, or some of the educational institutions like UCLA or the Bancroft Library in Berkeley, and on. So we're becoming a repository for multiple collections. But the other side is making it easier for filmmakers, authors, and others to use the materials. Example being, a filmmaker now could easily search for topics around maybe a documentary they're looking at. They can read the transcripts, but they can also download a high resolution video file so that they can easily use that in their film. So we're trying to expand the use in these stories. But the key legacy, as I talk about this, so I'm talking sort of like as an engineer, what I've come to realize, though, is the legacy of Densho in terms of the future is really the communities that are coming together, emerging, working together around learning about and keeping the story alive. And that's what I recognize in some ways the oral history interviews, the platform that we've created, are just really tools to get people to learn and work together and to hopefully act, to be more compassionate, to be more sensitive to what's going on in our world, especially around, I think, racism, around fear, around civil liberties, a lot of the issues that we're grappling with today. And so what we're seeing, and the beauty of this is now happening all around the country and even in different countries, where people are using the Densho platform to learn about these what happened through these oral history, personal stories, along with this context, and are working with other people. And that's the exciting part. That's going to be the legacy, and where we will spend more and more of our time and efforts in terms of how do we connect this incredible knowledge base in ways that it becomes much more active, much more alive in terms of it being relevant. And I think that's something that we want to share with other oral historians, other collections, because I think that's the power of oral histories that I think is so underutilized. That we have all these incredible stories that we've all collected and preserved, but if we can get used out there in ways that can inform how we think about the world, that's where I think the power is, and that's where I think the future of Densho will go towards.
I could not agree more. That's a very powerful statement. I guess I could open the door up to you. Is there anything else you would like to share about Densho or anything?
Well, the one thing is, as people hear this and recognizing that oral histories can be so powerful, just opening up that, you know, we would love to work with other collections, other oral historians, to really forward this thinking. That I coming from the community and seeing how powerful these stories are in terms of activating and encouraging and inspiring communities to action, I just want to see more of that. And in particular, I want to see this around collections around communities of color and other communities that, you know, have been targeted and have been vulnerable in the past. I think those stories are, you know, kind of the gems that we can learn so much from. So what I'll put out there is, you know, this idea, this request that, you know, let's work together on this.
That's lovely. Yes, on that note, Tom, I want to thank you so much for talking with me and the Oral History Review today about Densho. It is such an incredible project. Thank you so much for sharing.
No, thank you, Nicole. This is, as you can tell, this is something I'm not only passionate about, but I enjoy talking about. And so thank you so much for reaching out to me.
No problem.